Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast, the week of September 24th. And we're pleased to have with us this week our editor, Drew Christensen. Welcome, Father Drew.
Good to be with you, Tim. Good to be with our readers and listeners.
Well, we want to say that this is a valedictory podcast for you since you're ending your tenure at America just this month. But we'll get to that later. First, we want to pick up a couple topics that we're covering in the magazine these days. The first is we had this forum on kind of the future of moral theology after the case involving Sister Margaret Farley. Maybe you could introduce that to our listeners.
Well, Sister Margaret Farley happens to be my doctor mother, the woman who supervised my dissertation. She wrote a book, which was published in 2007, I believe, and received a coveted award in theological or religious writing down in Nashville, I think it's related to the Abingdon Press. But in any case, it's called Just Love, and basically it's about issues of justice in sexual relations and married love. This spring, early June, the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, the kind of doctrinal watchdogs of the Vatican, issued a notification, or an assessment, I'm sorry, not a notification, but an assessment of the book. It didn't look at the overall project of the book. It just looked at some particular issues in which Margaret took different positions than the magisterium on homosexuality, on masturbation, and some other issues. And also at the role that the magisterial teaching had to play in the ethics she worked out. Now, she was clear that her methodology was not to do a particularly Catholic ethic in this piece, but rather to try to apply this new paradigm, saying that justice really has a role in sexual relations. And I think most of the commentators I've read think that she's really made a contribution there. Some feel that, you know, as a Catholic moral theologian, she should have grappled more with the Catholic tradition. And particularly, I think, younger moral theologians who want to see Catholic moral theology related more emphatically to tradition do that. One of our authors, Julie Rubio from the University of St. Louis, noted that. She's a younger woman moral theologian herself. She also said that Margaret really made a contribution, that, you know, we've ignored the fact that justice does apply to sexual relations and that we need to include it more. Margaret, in addition, gave us language for dealing with differences with her, which I think is an important contribution. In any case, there was a lot of commentary by moral theologians at the time, and so we thought we would put together a forum by some noted theologians about the state of the role of the moral theologian today. Rick Gagliardi, who's well known to people as kind of the best-known systematic theologian writing about Vatican II today, wrote a piece about the magisterium and moral theologians. But interestingly, the title is Magisterium, Moral Theologians, and the Sense of the Faithful. So that what he includes, and I think this is very important for the future of sexual ethics, is to say, you know, we need to consult the faithful. And he points out that the International Theological Commission, in a document also approved by the CDF last spring, indicated that the sense of the faithful was basic to the articulation of the faith, and that in a couple of key documents of Vatican, the Council put it at the basis of the bishop's teaching. So consulting the faithful is not optional. It's really important, and it's something that's been really neglected. Jim Bretsky, who teaches at Boston College and has taught at our school in Berkeley and at the University of San Francisco, trained in Rome, writes about kind of the various audiences that the moral theologian has to address. That is, that moral theologian is within the academy, but needs to address an audience in the church that consists of both bishops and lay people, and is trying to advise pastors and pastoral counselors and others about how to handle difficult moral questions. And so that it's a kind of balancing act, and I'll cover our artist for the cover caught a good image of that with a person walking between two skyscrapers on a tightrope, which is the job of the moral theologian. The moral theologian is not just to be a secretary for the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, repeating what it has to say, but rather someone that explores people's actual problems and tries to articulate real solutions to them and then reflect them back to the church and create a dialogue within the church. And I've said something a bit about Julia Rubio's position already, that Margaret has made a contribution. Unlike many others, she didn't just leave the book without critique, but she basically gives a pretty favorable interpretation of the book's task, as did others. I think Ricciardi, too, says this is a task that needed to be done. It could have been done differently. Others would have done it differently, but this is the way it's done. Let's continue the dialogue about this.
And there's a very helpful introduction from the editors laying out a bit of the history, especially in light of Vatican II. And we could speak about that, kind of how this is one of the perhaps piece of unfinished business, the kind of the role of moral theology today.
Yeah, I think that, myself, that moral theology has not been renewed as the council intended. The one reference we have to that, talking about training of seminarians and so on, talks about renewing moral theology in the light of biblical studies in particular. And that never happened. And the reason it didn't happen, because we quickly got lost in disputes first over birth control, then later over abortion, that turned Catholic moral theologians back to the old casuistic tradition done in natural law terms. And much of that natural law writing introduced new standards of absoluteness in moral principles that hadn't existed in the earlier tradition. I think if you look at a recent document by the International Theological Commission, you see a much more flexible, open notion of natural law as a common human wisdom than we get in kind of what's in the casuistic natural law tradition. And I think natural law theology could be really invigorated if it took up the kind of vision of that school of moral theology that the International Theological Commission put forward. I think the council showed us where moral theology should go. It did a number of things that were novel, for instance, introducing the notion of unity in marriage, as interpersonal unity, as one of the twin goals of marriage, which was an innovation, or elevating once more the role of conscience, the conscience of believers in the Declaration on Religious Liberty, asking us to look at war with a whole new attitude and beginning to spin off the Catholic peace movements and other things, so that it really did model what that new moral theology should be like, without kind of laying out a program for the renewal of moral theology. And I think that still needs to be done.
That's what, in part, this forum was about, was exploring these questions. And hopefully the conversation will continue and we'll perhaps get some good letters to continue.
Good, good.
Now, this just shows one side of your expertise you've brought to the job as editor of America, as your background in ethics and moral theology. But also at America, you've had to grapple with contemporary events, political questions, especially now. You know, we're looking towards the election in November, and you just gave a talk out at Marquette University titled How to Keep Our Heads Amid the Craziness, Catholic Reflections on the 2012 Elections. We have this up on our website, but maybe you can just introduce it to our folks.
The invitation to give this lecture came from the Partnership Council of the Wisconsin Province, which is a group of lay people that helped the province with its development needs and supporting the Jesuit elderly and scholastics in study, as well as the missions in East Africa. I agreed quickly because Wisconsin had just assigned Luke Hansen here as an associate editor. Luke is here as a regent, and I was just so delighted at that that I was very grateful. I immediately said yes, and then a couple of days later, I called back and I said, "You sure you want me to come to Wisconsin and give a talk on the elections?"
Right. This is before Paul Ryan.
This is before Paul Ryan, but it's actually in Paul Ryan's backyard. Janesville's in the suburbs of Milwaukee.
Sure. Yeah.
That was part of the situation. It's also that the politics in Wisconsin have been particularly heated and divided over the actions of Governor Walker and cutting out the rights of public union employees, and then cutting back on their benefits and so on, and then going through a recall election, which he barely won. So I knew it was difficult territory. I originally thought I was going to talk more specifically about reform of the electoral process, things like campaign finance reform, redistricting, shortening campaigns, having regional primaries, perhaps, things that would make the electoral process simpler, more focused, and hopefully more intelligent. But as time went on and the discussions were so extensive but so shallow and so repetitive, I really got exasperated. And as kind of the meanness of misrepresentation and so on, there was something that needed to be done here that was beyond what dickering with the apparatus of the electoral process could do. And so the talk I gave was really about how we got to search our spiritual dispositions about civic life. And that if we find anger, if we find that we're always ready to put the other side down, if we're not ready to listen and so on, we have some serious accounting to do for ourselves. And then I talk about how that change can come about, and particularly how it can come about in prayer. I mentioned I just before going up to Milwaukee, I had an after-dinner discussion with a New York financier who's a good Catholic, a conservative, but he, because of the state of the campaign, he couldn't decide what to do. And he was telling me, you know, I'm praying about this all the time at Mass, with the rosary, with my other devotions. And I said, that's essentially what we have to do. But I said, it's not just a prayer petition, it's a prayer of an open heart. That really is where we need to go to be able to begin to resolve this thing. And I talk about some experiences, but particularly two things that emanate from laying one's heart open. One is the purification of our affections and the cleansing, therefore, of negative affections so that we can look more objectively at the situation, and particularly the clarification of those affections so that we can embrace our fellow citizens with a more open heart. As I say, to Ignatian virtues of generosity and magnanimity. And I think that's where renewal will come. I think unless there is that spirit of openness that goes to generosity and magnanimity, we're really going to be stuck in tit for tat and polarization for a long, long time. And so I'm hoping that this may be a big beginning. I was very encouraged by the number of people in Milwaukee who really wanted to read this so they could ponder it and take it to heart.
Yes, that was my next question. How was it received in Paul Ryan's home state?
It seemed to be received very well. One woman who obviously was a Republican conservative said she was just amazed to learn that Thomas Jefferson was down there with the gutter snipes. For the first time she'd heard from me that though Jefferson was brilliant in many ways, that he engaged in very negative campaigning in his campaigns. And I compared him to Washington, who, you know, resigned as commander-in-chief and then later resigned as president after two terms with a certain kind of modesty and self-control, with lack of overweening ambition. And, you know, he was the model of the citizen. He himself took Cincinnatus as a model and the Roman general. So, but I think that we need more of that kind of modesty in politics.
Well, maybe we can turn to just looking back. It's been 7 years you've been editor here. You've brought a special interest in the world church, the situation of Christians in the Middle East, the situation of Christians in China. There's many issues that you've been passionate about, but maybe you can talk about some of those, some of the lessons you've learned in those years.
One of the first decisions the editors took when I assumed the editorship was that I wouldn't take a high-profile public role, that I'd be public, I'd speak publicly about the things that I was an expert in, you know, war and peace, environment, you know, the church in the Middle East, you know, to some extent China, and that the magazine would be better off if the editor-in-chief was not personalizing critiques of the way things were developing in the church in one way or another. And that I think that served us well. I think we've had our differences with people within the church, including the hierarchy. But I think the fact that I've kind of kept the low pose, not being a star, as John Carr once said, has helped the magazine. On the other hand, we have a distribution of labor. So Jim Martin has handled our press relations by and large and developed a very distinctive style for handling those kind of difficult questions. He's so public, people don't realize how many stories he's killed and how many people he sent in other directions rather than taking himself. But he has his own peculiar genius, and I think we all contribute that way. So we were able to continue our editorial choices with our editorializing, advancing things where we'd want to, without drawing too much fire because the editor-in-chief had become a too public person. So I think that's one very important lesson learned. The other thing, certainly, is that as I've write in my closing of many things column, it was a time of white water management. There's no lender crises. For most of the time, I was president, and for a couple of years, I was publisher as well, and I opened position of publisher. I've had two publishers. But
this is of America Press.
The America Press.
The magazine.
So a lot of my work was unseen in terms of developing a new set of bylaws, bringing together a new dominant league lay board, getting them to take a sense of ownership of the magazine, trying a number of times to see whether we could sell the building for an endowment, defending our America brand and that trademark battle, which we won, but something that I hadn't looked forward to, but we had to do, and we were successful at. There were a lot of things that went into this the editorship in my tenure that may not be there for an editor-chief in the future. He can focus more explicitly on the content of the magazine and the website and not have to worry about the governance and organization of things as much.
Now, the next step for you, you're taking a sabbatical, and then after that, what's next?
The next will be an appointment at Georgetown as a distinguished professor of ethics and human development. Georgetown has a new university-wide program in ethics and human development with special MAs in both the School of Foreign Service and the Public Policy Institute. My own appointment is to the School of Foreign Service and to the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. And I think that one of the places I'll be teaching ethics and human development will be in the School of Foreign Service. And that will put me back somewhere where I started. When I started doing social ethics in an international vein, I was really interested in advancing questions of justice and global development. That's what I had kind of minored in when I was in graduate school at Yale. But the church's own work in 1983 with the Peace Pastor, and later my own time at the Bishops' Conference, there was so much focus on conflict and rural trouble spots, especially the Middle East and the Balkans during my tenure, that I really got a reputation for those areas and attended less to the questions of development, so I'm returning there. And that's the function of the sabbatical, which will spend mostly at Boston College, will be to read myself back into the field of social ethics with an emphasis on ethics and international affairs, and especially on ethics and question of social development.
And we're going to look forward to you contributing to our blog in all things. So your voice is going to still be in the pages and on the websites of America.
Oh, yes, I think so. And I already want to do something on what's been going on in North Africa. I have a big editorial to finish. But once that editorial is done, I hope I can begin blogging about what's going on in the Middle East. We were just talking, you and I, about doing a webinar for the Catholic Press Association about the current situation in North Africa and the Middle East, which we'll be doing next week. But I'd like all our readers to be able to take advantage of that. This will be for other Catholic journalists to kind of fill them in on what's happening. But there's a lot there. And, I don't think that the American public generally gets to understand enough of the dynamics. I think Christopher Stevens, the killed ambassador, was a really great man. And, the future of the American presence in the Middle East really belongs to people like him who are willing to get down and work with the people on the streets, get to know them, befriend them, and help develop their institutions for the future of freedom and democracy in that part of the world.
Well, we look forward to your contributions and writings on that question and many others. Father Drew Christensen, we wish you luck.
Thanks, Tim. I wish you good luck, too. You got a lot more work to do on the web.
Yes, we're not finished yet. Thanks again.